Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 165 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her, knowing when you need to eat. Yeah, we have a terrific show coming up, and just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your official reminder to click onto iTunes after this episode to rate and review this show, because this is going to be a good one. And we look forward to hearing from you, and we sit around waiting all day long for your feedback, so you better do it. And there'll be another reminder later on. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Well, I have the absolute pleasure of having a good friend and colleague on the show, Dr. Courtney Peterson, who is assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And her research interests include meal timing, circadian rhythms, intermittent fasting, diet quality, and mathematical modeling of metabolism and body composition. Oh boy, the overarching goal of her research is to develop novel dietary interventions to prevent, treat, or reverse type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. Boy, that's a little mouthful right there. All right, so Courtney, I just know that you're becoming one of those new up-and-coming scientists looking at a brand new sector to a number of people out there in the consumer audience. And that is this, people have been reading now about meal timing, about circadian rhythm, about intermittent fasting. All these words are kicking around, and you've been able to conduct some early research now, beginning to put some of these pieces together, perhaps in a way that can be applied now to people, just common people out there are listening and learning and wanting to improve and enhance their own health and wellness. So first, Courtney, welcome to the Her podcast, and tell us more about this latest study that you just did with regard to time-restricted feeding. Tell us what that's all about.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. So I had been interested in intermittent fasting for a long time because I heard of all the wonderful benefits of it for improving your blood sugar, helping you potentially burn fat, and just improving your health overall. And what really put it on my radar was a study published in 2012 out of Sachin Panda's lab at the Salk Institute. And in that study, they were looking at something called time-restricted feeding. And what time-restricted feeding is, it's basically a form of intermittent fasting where you practice it every day. So what you're doing in time-restricted feeding is eating in a narrower time period each day and then having a longer fast period between dinner one day and breakfast the next. So you're basically eating in a condensed period. And in this study out of Sachin Panda's lab, they took rodents, and at random the rodents were either assigned to eat all their food in an 8-hour period and to fast for the remaining 16 hours of the day, or they ate the exact same amount of food, but they grazed throughout the day. And the amazing thing he found is despite the fact that both groups of rodents were eating the same amount of food, the group of rodents that ate all their food in an 8-hour period gained significantly less weight, had better blood sugar levels, lower cholesterol levels, and just across the board, they were much healthier than the rodents who grazed throughout the day. And that kind of flies in the face of what we've always thought, right? You always see these fitness and health magazines saying, you know, eat lots of small meals throughout the day to keep your metabolism revved up. And I saw his study, and I thought, wow, this is phenomenal. We really have to test this and see whether this is true in humans. And this was about 6 years ago. And around that same time, there was also some really interesting work coming out of Oren Froy and Daniela Jakubowicz's lab in Israel, and they were testing the old adage of eating breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper. And what they found is if you followed this sort of strategy, it actually helped you lose more weight. It lowered your blood sugar levels. And not only were you losing more weight, but you were less hungry while you were doing it, which I always thought was phenomenal. Meanwhile, the group that, you know, ate a small breakfast and a large dinner was struggling to lose weight and they were hungrier. And so I kind of put two and two together and I thought, well, what if we combined, you know, this time-restricted feeding and daily intermittent fasting with eating earlier in the day, potentially to be in alignment with circadian rhythms and metabolism. So we know your body has an internal body clock that makes you better at doing certain things at different times of the day. So, for instance, your best sports performance is in the afternoon, but conversely, your best blood sugar control is actually in the morning, and you digest food a little faster in the morning. So it all kind of made sense to me to combine the two.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. So what you said about breakfast then, oh my goodness, you know, this is, you know, that whole issue of, you know, is breakfast always necessary? Is breakfast supposed to be the main meal of the day, et cetera? What you're saying is this new research is sort of redefining that, wouldn't you say?
Correct. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to straddle two fields at the same time, both intermittent fasting and understanding the circadian clock or your internal biological clock. And I think the reason why breakfast skipping has been so confusing and controversial is when you skip breakfast, you can potentially be doing a form of intermittent fasting. So, for instance, if you ate dinner at a normal time and skipped breakfast, you know, you're eating in a shorter period of time. So, in theory, you should at least be getting some of the benefits of intermittent fasting. But due to the fact that you're skipping breakfast, you may be missing out on some of the benefits of circadian, of eating in alignment with your circadian rhythms. So the big question, which I don't think we know yet, is what's, you know, if you skip breakfast, and you're not, you know, pushing dinner back late, do you get benefits or not? And so that's one of, I think, the million-dollar questions out there. And you'll hear people hotly debate this. And there's not really a good answer out there in the research. There is some data suggesting that whether you skip breakfast or not doesn't seem to affect weight loss very much or actually not at all. But it wasn't a very well-controlled trial. Conversely, there also have been some studies looking at breakfast skipping on blood sugar levels, but they've all been only a day long, so we don't really know whether the results are true or not in the long term, and we'd expect the body to adapt over time. So we just don't even know the answer yet. So I think, you know, a lot of people tend to feel strongly about, you know, either one viewpoint or the other, and I'd say we just don't know because, you know, you have to consider both of these aspects of meal timing, you know, both the intermittent fasting angle and the circadian rhythms angle. And what was really interesting is in the early days of looking at different intermittent fasting approaches, no one really had circadian rhythms on their radar. So they were often having people do their fasting period, or sorry, I should say their eating period late in the day. So we may not have actually been reaping as many benefits from some of these early studies on intermittent fasting as we potentially could have.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I've been asked this question a million times. I'm sure you have too. if you're doing like a 16-8 type of regimen, very much like what Dr. Panda did with the mice, et cetera, and of course we have that brand new study by Dr. Krista Verity on the 16-8 in obese individuals that just came out. You know, in 8 hours, really, you can only fit in two good meals. I don't see how it's possible to really put three meals in 8 hours. There's just not enough time. I could be wrong, but there you have it. So if that's true, one meal's got to go. And the only meals that are really in play to go, if you're going to really truly do the time-restricted feeding, especially as Panda has outlined, is either breakfast or dinner. You know, one of those has got to go. Because lunch seems to be whatever you're going to call that, you know, that meal there, that lunch is in the middle, so it's a player, but the other two have to go. And I've watched, you know, at the end of the day, it really depends upon your lifestyle and the needs and obligations of all the social stuff you do. So if you're if you've got kids and you want to share dinner with the kids, that's one thing. Or you eat earlier, that's another way to kind of, you know, solve a bit of the issue. But the issue also stands that a lot of people elect to blow off breakfast because they just so enjoy the social issues involved with dinner. You know, they want to sit down with their family and, you know, and back and forth. So I think a lot of people, I mean, I would be bold now to say that a lot of people would blow off breakfast in deference to, you know, the dinner thing just because of their social obligations. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's I think most people are probably going to be willing to do time-restricted feeding by skipping breakfast rather than dinner. And I think, you know, social issues are a big factor, but I think there are a bunch of encouraging things here. So I think the first of them, or the first point that's really encouraging, is there have been at least two studies in rodents now that found that following time-restricted feeding 5 out of 7 days a week produced nearly the same benefits as following it all 7 days a week. So that, to me, suggests you don't have to do it every day to get most of the benefits. So, you know, regardless of whether you're doing time-restricted feeding early in the day or late in the day, you're still probably getting most of the benefits of that schedule. The other thing that's interesting is I suspect, you know, you asked about the number of meals per day and, you know, and whether you need to eat fewer meals per day. And, you know, I think time-restricted feeding, regardless of what time of day you eat it, my hypothesis is that it probably reduces food intake. And the reason why is because you're basically in a fat-burning mode for most of the day. So that prevents large swings in blood sugar and so forth. But actually, interestingly, in both of the studies that we've done in my lab, we looked at time-restricted feeding early in the day. So we had people actually eat their last meal of the day before 3 p.m. and then fast for the rest of the day. So, you know, fairly extreme. But we made them eat 3 meals a day, and they were able to do it. What was interesting is they said the fasting part of eating 3 meals a day was not that difficult, but stuffing in all that food in a 6-hour period with the 3 meals was quite challenging. But interestingly, in one of our studies, it was a 4-day study, we found that time-restricted feeding did reduce appetite throughout the day. It also reduced 24-hour blood sugar levels, and although it didn't help people burn more calories, it did look like it was helping them burn more fat. So we're pretty excited about that. So overall, we think a lot of the benefits, though potentially not all, are due to the fact that, you know, time-restricted feeding really does help curb your appetite because, you know, you have these nice, easy rules that you follow, so that's going to limit snacking, but also because potentially some of the fat-burning benefits we're seeing.
Yeah, and the other... Well, okay. So when you say fat burning, I want to make sure that all of our listeners understand what that's really all about with this. Why are people on time-restricted feeding, you know, more apt to burn fat?
Yeah, we think the reason why they're more apt to burn fat is just they have a longer period without eating each day. And as a result, you know, part of it is maybe due to the fact that when you're eating in a small period of time, you get the benefit of something called the second meal effect. And that's when you eat a meal shortly after, you know, a second meal shortly after a first meal, and your blood sugar levels end up not spiking as high. And part of that's due to insulin. And so insulin's the hormone that helps keep your blood sugar levels under control and moves sugar out of your bloodstream and into your cells. And so what happens with this second meal effect is, you know, insulin levels are already kind of elevated from your first meal. So they help keep your blood sugar levels kind of lower, and that helps you access more fat burning per se. And then the other factor may just be that you have such a long period of time each day when your insulin levels are lower that you're able to enter and stay in fat burning for a longer period of time each day.
Gotcha. So I know that a lot of our listeners are probably wondering, okay, I get it with the phase where you're not eating, not a problem. But the big question is, what do you eat? there's some magic to, you know, the type of dietary intake during the time that you're actually eating, whether it's where they're doing a 12-12 or you're doing a 16-8 or anything in between. What are you supposed to eat? You've got paleo and keto and God knows what else out there. Does it matter?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a very hard question to answer too. So what's interesting is if you look at some of Dr. Panda's original studies in rodents, his 2012 paper shows that if you look at the data and you're interpreting it correctly, it actually shows what you eat matters a little bit more than when you eat, but they both matter a lot. So, you know, people who say that, oh, only when you eat matters, you know, that's not true. We still think food quality matters a lot and probably more than when you eat. What's interesting is some people have suggested to me that, you know, maybe when you eat matters much more when you're on an unhealthy diet. And that may be the case. So if you're on an unhealthy diet, your insulin levels are going to be quite high or elevated. And so just by doing the time-restricted feeding, you know, if you do have problems with your blood sugar control, we think you'll respond even more to, you know, changing the timing of when you eat. As to when you eat, I generally advise people to eat both good carbs and good fats. So, you know, so obviously things like avocados, nuts, seeds, you know, fish can be good as well. And for carbs, I recommend people steer more towards, you know, the starchy vegetables, fruits, beans, and stay away from grains, especially refined grains, particularly any sort of grain, even if it's a whole grain that's in flour form, because even a whole grain, if it's ground to a flour, is going to spike your blood sugar levels just because it's ground to such a small particle size that carbohydrate will enter your gastrointestinal system very rapidly.
Okay. And so there are certain times of day when certain macronutrients are better metabolized, correct?
There's a little bit of data in people on this, but most of it's in rodents. There is some data that suggests that eating fat, a higher fat meal early in the day and keeping your carbohydrates for later in the day is better. But I'd say the research is pretty early or pretty preliminary so far.
Now, we've been talking about circadian rhythm. Can you describe and define what that is so that everyone out there understands it? We've talked about time-restricted feeding, but what is circadian rhythm and how do they both work together?
Yeah, so a circadian rhythm is any sort of 24-hour pattern or rhythm in either your physiology or metabolism or behavior. So, for instance, you have a rhythm in terms of there's certain times a day that your muscles are actually stronger than other times a day. So, for instance, your muscles tend to be strongest in the afternoon and a little weaker at other times of the day. You also have a rhythm in your blood sugar control. So what's really interesting is we've known for the past 50 years now that your blood sugar control is actually better in the morning than it is in the afternoon and the evening. And it's quite a large difference. So if you give people a blood sugar test in the morning and then give them the same test in the afternoon and the evening, their blood sugar levels, you know, if you drink, say, a sugary drink, will spike much higher in the afternoon and the evening. So these are real rhythms that are generated by your biological clock. And part of that clock resides in your brain in an area called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that, what's really interesting is the clock that's in your brain, its time zone is basically set by when you get bright light exposure. So this is kind of the basis of how you adjust to different time zones. But you also have a bunch of, technically, you actually have a bunch of clocks throughout your body. So you can think of each organ or tissue as having its own clock. And so those, we think of a single biological clock, but it's actually a bunch of clocks all working together. And what's really interesting is that these clocks that are in the rest of your body, their time zone is set by a variety of factors, but it looks like the most important factor is the timing of when you eat. So the punchline is if, you know, some of your clocks respond to bright light and some respond to when you eat, what that means is if ever you're getting bright light exposure at night, meaning, bright blue light from your computer, or, you know, who knows what, or you're sleeping with the lights on. Or conversely, if you're eating late at night, your clocks will think they're in different time zones, so they give conflicting signals to your metabolism about whether to rev up or rev down. So this is the kind of basis of why we think the time of day that you eat affects your health. It's because, you know, if you're eating at the wrong time of day, you know, that basically causes your clocks to be in different time zones, and so it's hard for them to properly control your metabolism.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that issue of time zone and in body clocks. I think that that's a really cool way for people to identify with something that sounds familiar to them. And I think that a lot of people think that the body clock is more than likely mostly affected by light. And that's true of the master and the brain because of the neuronal hookups. But if you're looking at the microbiome, if you're looking at, you know, an internal organ, they're really responding to when you eat. That's why they're not responding to, I mean, there are a number of factors that obviously are going to affect this, everything from sleep on. But I don't think people fully realize, Courtney, how important it is that when you eat, truly and very critically affects the cellular metabolism and what kind of signals it's going to be sending out. I think that that's very huge. That's like a news breaking item here for most people to understand that when they eat chaotically, they leave their body in chaos, right?
Yep. You said it perfectly. Yeah. And I think what's really interesting is if you go back and look at all the different trials on intermittent fasting in people, there have been a number, for instance, that had participants fast throughout the day, so which would be kind of equivalent to skipping both breakfast and dinner. So, for instance, Mark Mattson's group at the NIH had done an intermittent fasting trial. We didn't have the term time-restricted feeding then, but effectively what they were doing was time-restricted feeding, where the participants ate between about 5 p.m. at night and 9 p.m. at night. So it was a four-hour period, so it was quite an extreme, you know, form of time-restricted feeding. And, of course, they expected the participants to do better with the intermittent fasting, but actually they found the opposite, which was that participants' blood sugar levels actually got worse when they fasted, you know, for most of the day and ate in the evening. And, moreover, their cholesterol levels, their blood pressure levels and so forth also got worse. And, you know, it took us a while, I think, to figure out why that is. But that's why I'm really fascinated in the question of, you know, not only, you know, how beneficial time-restricted feeding is, but, you know, how do those effects depend on the time of day? So I had done a pilot study, and in addition to the four-day study I mentioned earlier, we just came out with a five-week study that was published in the journal Cell Metabolism, where we tried doing time-restricted feeding early in the day. So participants, you know, ate all their meals before 3 p.m. and then fasted the rest of the day. In that study, we found improvements in insulin sensitivity, blood pressure. We also found a reduction in oxidative stress to lipids, so basically less damage to fat molecules in the body. And also actually a reduction in hunger at nighttime. So that's all very compelling. And then the next phase of what we plan to do in the lab is we just got funding for a large study, a much larger study than what the two studies we've already done, to look at time-restricted feeding when practiced at different times of day. So we really want to nail this question. How much of the benefits of time-restricted feeding are due to the length of your feeding and fasting period versus your quote-unquote circadian timing of food intake or the time of day that you eat?
That's quite fascinating because I think, you know, something that has haunted all of us who've looked at this is, you know, what's going to be the more critical, you know, factor here. I think a lot of people take, you know, the 14-10 or however they're doing it, and they just sort of, you know, make it up as they go along. So they'll say, well, you know, I'm going to choose X number of hours. You've got a lot of night owls who will defer to eating more in the evening. You know, my husband's one of those. But he keeps himself in magnificent shape. He just stays on top of it all. Somehow he makes it work. because he can't un-night owl himself. You know, I'm a lark and he's an owl, so that's the way that little story goes. But it would make sense to me that, you know, starting earlier in the day, you know, when the Tweety birds are out and all of a sudden, you know, light hits and we're ready to rock and roll, that you'd really want to have a mind and body that's ready to go out and hunt and forage, be highly focused, energized, and be more apt to have higher levels of peak performance, both from mind and body. So having better blood sugar management helps. You know, better insulin sensitivity helps. To have optimized blood pressure helps. All of those things, I think, feed into that. And we're not seeing that in the evening when, for all intent and purposes, I assume our primal software is saying, go to sleep for crying out loud. And you're not supposed to be out there highly focused on hunting and foraging at 10 p.m. at night. I'm just being incredibly ridiculously simplistic about this, but it just seems to make more sense to me. Yes? No? What do you think?
Right, absolutely. And if you look at data from our closest ancestors, primates, they tend to eat over about a 9 to 10 hour period with their, they don't eat meals in the same way, but if you look at large feeding bouts, their last large feeding bout is between about 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. And then they eat very little after that. So, I think there's some clues there about what we're optimized to do. It all makes sense evolutionarily. And actually, Ev Van Cotter had done some really interesting work in this area, and she was actually able to find that the time of day that your blood sugar control is best on average is around 11 a.m., so it's late morning. And, you know, that's just around the time of, you know, peaks where the sun peaks in the sky. So it all kind of seems to make sense that, you know, we were probably optimized for eating most of our food in the morning or, you know, shortly after noon. So together, I think it makes a very clear, compelling story.
Did the primal, you know, the people who study this primal eating and the rest of it, were they looking at the total number of bouts of eating? Were they saying that indeed, I can only imagine, it was a little rough 2 million years ago. And so, you know, I mean, you and I have to laugh about three squares and snacks. I mean, really? Seriously? I mean, you wake up in the morning, you're in a cave somewhere. There's no fridge. There's no Starbucks. You know, you're on your own. And as Mark Mattson has said, his TEDx, you know, at Hopkins was excellent in this regard. Our brains were truly hardwired to be able to go out there when it was real funky and tough and food was, you know, hard to score, that you may be hunting and foraging for quite some time in a fasted state because, you know, there's no guarantee what's going on out there, Mother Nature. And if you scored something, you scored something. And I can't imagine they would have anything more than two meals a day. You know, one was probably a celebration. Two, they probably fell over with gratitude. Three is laughable. Just like, really? So I think what you and I are saying, in many respects, just it flies in the face of what current philosophy is in nutrition today. What do you think?
I think so, but I think, you know, things are very rapidly evolving. I think if you talk to most researchers these days, they no longer think we should be grazing. Now, the message may not have trickled out to healthcare providers like doctors or dietitians
yet.
But at least among researchers, I think we've seen a rapid turnaround in our understanding. And I think the big question in my mind is, right now, is what intermittent fasting approaches are and are not effective. And, you know, in the general public, you pretty much hear or think that all approaches are effective, but that's not the case. And there are a variety of different approaches. So we talked just about time-restricted feeding or daily intermittent fasting today, but there are two other kinds of categories of intermittent fasting. So one, and these are my own categories, which I like to talk about because it helps us make sense of all the different strategies, but the other two categories are approaches where you fast for at least 24 hours at a time, some number of days per week or days per month, So that an example of that would be alternate day fasting, where every other day you have a complete 24-hour fast. And this is the form of intermittent fasting that's most been studied in rodents. And then the other sort of large category are your modified fasting approaches, where you do a very low-calorie diet some number of times per week or per month. And examples there include the 5-2 diet, which is popular in the UK, or alternate day modified fasting. This is what Christo Vardi has spent a lot of time studying. So every other day you eat, you know, something like only 25% of your normal calories. And then the fasting mimicking diet, which I know you've had Walter Longo on your show. And what's interesting is, you know, actually, Chris, the studies on alternate day modified fasting found that if you follow people for a year, they're no better off if they've done alternate day modified fasting than if they did daily dieting, like literally no difference. So there are no benefits. And moreover, she found that among people who are trying to lose weight, those who are trying to lose weight with alternate day modified fasting tended to drop out at a higher rate. So all in all, that kind of unfortunately sheds a negative light on alternate day modified fasting. And then there was also, you know, Mark Mattson's study where the intermittent fasting and, you know, by eating in the evening was not beneficial. So not all approaches may work. So I think, you know, it's an exciting time to be in the field now, because I think, you know, there's a lot of different things we can do. There are a lot of big picture questions about different types of intermittent fasting strategies. There are questions such as, is overeating on your feeding day okay, or does that negate a lot of the benefits? So there are a lot of questions out there that we need to answer. So I think it's a good time to be in this area.
Excellent. And, you know, as we're kind of drawing this to a close, say once again, how should someone, you know, really be eating on days when, you know, well, on every single day, as they're looking at just a ridiculous number of options out there with, you know, again, paleo, keto, and all the rest of it. How does someone choose from all of that? Or should that you just simply say, eat whole foods and call it a day?
Yeah, great question. So on the topic of meal timing, I generally recommend one of two strategies for people who want to do something several days a week. One strategy I recommend is for people who, you know, need to keep their meal times fixed for, you know, family or social life. I recommend making dinner your smallest meal of the day and shifting most of your food intake, most of your eating to breakfast and lunch. So this is the strategy of eat dinner like a pauper. And breakfast like a king. So that's one kind of strategy that there are now nearly half a dozen clinical trials in humans showing that that kind of approach improves everything from weight loss to even ovulation in women who were, you know, having problems conceiving, which is pretty mind-blowing. And then the other kind of approach is the time-restricted feeding, which we discussed. And based on our pilot research, we recommend as a good target for people to try to eat in an 8 to 10 hour period. If you're highly motivated, you know, by all means, you're welcome to try the 6-hour period that we did. Our studies, we weren't going for feasibility the first time. We just wanted to show whether there are benefits or not. But I think, you know, that 8 to 10 hour period each day and having that period be either early in the day, so meaning eating dinner in the mid-afternoon, or in the middle of the day, so maybe you start eating around 10 or 11 in the morning and finish around like 6 p.m. at night or so, like in Christo Vardi's recent study. And then on the issue of diet quality, I'm not sure we have a great answer for you yet. And in the absence of a lack of good answer, I would say, you know, focus mostly on whole foods, with the one exception that I personally recommend avoiding foods made with whole grains when those whole grains are ground into flour form, like your breads and your pastas. But I think there's some intriguing evidence out there, both for things ranging, ketogenic diet has very impressive weight loss outcomes. We still need to understand that better. There are also some high-carb diets, you know, that also have some impressive results. So I don't think it'll be the last word on that, so I wouldn't give a specific prescription yet, but just say watch that space.
I see. And one last thing about the keto you mentioned, some people are saying, well, if it's ketogenic, then, you know, as you know, when during the probably within the first 6 hours or so, of the fasting phase of the intermittent fasting or time restricted feeding, at some point you should be entering a state of ketosis, which then launches a number of metabolic processes. So if you maintain on a ketogenic diet, does this just sort of keep the party going 24/7?
Yeah, a lot of people have told me that they practice both time-restricted feeding and a ketogenic diet and feel that it goes really nicely hand-in-hand because you're in nutritional ketosis the whole time. Transitioning is much easier. So I've heard lots of good anecdotal feedback so far.
But we don't really have any good studies on this at all.
Yeah, there are none so far.
Yeah, nothing that I have found. And I have one last final question. You know autophagy, and that is, you know, what I love to call the house cleaning and the cellular cleaning of the body, which actually takes place during a state of fasting, especially ketosis. And the question is, if you're eating during ketosis, is that interfering with autophagy?
I don't know the literature in this area as well, but I suspect it does, but I don't know the answer on that one.
Interesting. I mean, these are fascinating questions. And you know something? Everyone out there, we have been so absolutely lucky and grateful to have Dr. Courtney Peterson with us on this segment as we talk about time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting, and some of her cutting-edge research in this field. I can't begin to thank you enough for your shedding light on this and also your expertise and wisdom so that our listeners can get a better, more credible handle on what's going on in this whole field. Because you know something, every headline, you know what I'm saying, the blogs, yep. The onlines are all filled with this right now, and I'd say about a good 50% of it is just mishmash. So it's great to be able to connect with a true academician and researcher who can really help us set this straight. Courtney, thank you so much for being on the HER podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Always, and everyone out there, please take a minute to hit iTunes right now. Rate and review this wonderful show. This episode's been an eye-opener. You know it. We're sitting here waiting to hear from you because I love your feedback. And I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the HER podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every episode of the HER podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. And hey, stay well.